Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude, and today is March 18th. Let me just share with the radio audience, this is our first remote taping of our show. Obviously, at the time of COVID-19, where we're beginning to understand the concept of what maybe a variation of sheltering in place is going to mean, everything is going to be done differently. This is our first remote. Please forgive us for mistakes, but understand it will get better with time as we all adjust to a changing environment. As we do on this show, we begin every show with the words of Colonel Vindman. I want to remind everyone that it was in November of 2019 that Colonel Vindman had a powerful opening statement during the impeachment hearing, where he sort of reminded his father that it would be all right. I just want to remind everyone, it is not all right. It was not all right then. It is less all right now. So the words of Colonel Vindman.
Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, everyone, let me welcome our first guest on our first remote show. And actually, we have interviewed Henry Graeber from Slate.com on a number of occasions. He is a fabulous writer, and he almost seems to be prescient in everything that he writes, and he is the most appropriate person to begin our show. Henry, you wrote a piece, and I was reading it, and it just, oh my God, I reread it this morning. It was entitled, "We're Not Going Back to the Way Life Was Before. Thanks to the coronavirus, the future may arrive earlier than expected." So, Henry, as I was thinking about your piece all last night and this morning, I suddenly realized, you know, in 2013, my husband died. And I remember our sense of incredible loneliness and what it was like not to be engaged with someone, not to touch someone, not to have a lot of sort of public activities that he would drag me into. And I thought, can I ever adjust? And I feel like in a bizarre way, the death of my husband has prepared me for this new life with COVID-19. But talk to our audience about your incredibly important piece, because what I wanted everyone to know was that you begin with the idea of what a lot of businesses liked, which was called the agglomeration effect. So why don't you share your thoughts, because you're kind of like thinking out loud in this piece.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction, Arnie. I was asked initially to write about how some of the changes we're seeing, the empty highways, the empty airports, and so on, about how they have actually produced this sort of silver lining, which is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And it made me think about, you know, is this like sort of a preview of what it might look like if we really made a dedicated effort to slow things down, to stop moving around so much. And I started sort of thinking out loud about some of these things. I think the virus will pass. At some point, things will go back to some kind of normal. But it also seems clear to me at this point that the disruption is going to be so severe that there will be permanent changes in the way people live and work and play. And I don't think those things will relate necessarily to the fear of pandemic. It's not that in 2 years, people will still be worried about touching the pole on the bus or something like that. But rather that it's such a prominent and thorough disruption that it's going to change or accelerate a lot of existing trends, force people to make new decisions. A small example of this that I saw today was that this really creates an incentive for workers to align themselves with big firms. Because if you're at a bigger company, I think you have a lot more leeway right now. You have more resources available. You have the sort of cushion of a larger company that's less likely to go under during a disruption. And I think that people in New York, where I'm from, the disruption in restaurants and bars has been really, really severe. And I think many people are worried about their livelihoods, and I think it's going to cause a big awakening for everyone about the holes in the social safety net. That if you weren't already thinking about that, I think that's going to be pretty prominent. So that might just be the tip of the iceberg.
So, you know, a couple of things. You wrote initially about the fact that, you know, with all this shutting down of everything, it may in fact do some things to sort of clean the air and stop pollution. And my daughter lives in Shanghai. And that was one of the comments that she made immediately was, wow, Mom, I actually get to see the sky. I was like, I think in your article, you mentioned there was like a 30% reduction in pollution. And people are looking at this and they're breathing easier, which actually means that there are less health complications from pollution. And people are trying to figure out, yes, they want their economy to go back in China, but they kind of like the idea that you can take a breath. It's like, you know, it's how do you make these choices between an economy and being able to breathe? And yet at the same time, the other thing about China that also may help them in another interesting way is that you also pointed out that, yes, we're not going to go back to whatever normal was before. And not only can't we, but we shouldn't. And you mentioned in your article the idea that we should begin to decouple from China. Because, you know, you walk into Walmart and everything is made in China. All the face masks are made in China. Many of our medications are made in China. And I keep thinking about the idea that as we had all these trade agreements and we outsourced everything, what we're suddenly learning about is that we make nothing anymore. We become a service economy, but services require you to have something to serve. And if you're not making anything and depending on the rest of the world, then when something like this happens, then maybe you begin to realize that you need to sort of restore that sort of safety net of making things.
I think there's no doubt that there's going to be a reevaluation of our relationship with China, and not just from the standpoint that we need to reevaluate the supply chains. Of course, that's important. It now seems like an enormous national security issue that we don't have the capacity to manufacture a bunch of masks overnight. And I think there are a number of ways in which it's clear that we were not prepared for something like this, in no small part thanks to the Trump administration, but also it's just sort of, I think everyone's pretty surprised by the scale of this. And then the second thing about China is that I think that it's not just about the supply chains, it's also about the way that China is now reacting in this sort of second phase of the pandemic. We've already seen Chinese government officials try and sort of turn this around and say this actually didn't start in China, maybe it started in America. We've now seen Beijing just moved to expel reporters from the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. I think that when this is all over, that is the U.S. relationship with China is definitely one thing that is not going to be the same when we come out on the other side of this.
Well, the idea that they've been blaming the U.S., I mean, so you got the Wuhan virus, which is what Trump calls it, and months ago, because again, my daughter lives in Shanghai, that was the rumor on the street starting about 3 months ago, that it was us that caused this, that this was really the U.S.'s fault. So both sides are basically playing their old role of blaming the other, all right? It's not surprising. But I think the other thing is I heard someone say on the air the other day that, you know, imagine if the military asked the Chinese to build our nuclear weapons. Imagine if the military said, you know, build our bombs so that we can use them in future. In a lot of ways, what we did, what we're realizing with COVID-19 is we keep calling it kind of a war, you know, that we're fighting this virus. And what we're suddenly realizing is that by outsourcing so many of the pharmaceutical drugs, because it was cheaper to do it, by outsourcing so many of the supply chains, we basically sort of outsourced our own ability to weaponize against the virus. And that is a concern, because we've been told that trade was such a valuable thing and they could do it cheaper and this was all about profit. And, you know, people who complained about all the different trade agreements were told to worry only, you know, look what you did to labor, look what you did to manufacturing. Well, look what you did to our sense of national security, Henry.
Yeah, I think that's, there's going to be a big reckoning about this. I mean, there's a number of ways in which I don't think we should go overboard in blaming China for America's lack of preparation.
I'm not blaming China.
A separate scandal.
Right. You know, we made those decisions long ago and had nothing to do with China. It was just, it was cheaper. It would be Vietnam. It was cheaper. I mean, it's not country specific. It's a desire to you know, basically de-employ the American worker and find a cheaper worker so that companies can make profit. And then we can sort of, you know, be told, okay, you can have your salary slashed and find a gig job or find a service job, but you're not going to make it anymore.
Yeah. And here's an interesting thing that's going to happen too. It's not that companies will make the decision to withdraw from China necessarily, because they now feel that they now feel that it's too remote or too risky a supply chain. That might happen. But the other thing that's going to happen is that companies moved their manufacturing to China, let's say 15, 20 years ago, when it really was much, much cheaper to have things made in China. And that discrepancy between manufacturing in China and manufacturing in the US is no longer quite so large, because the Chinese economy has gotten so much better, workers there are making so much more money. So this is where I say that it does present this opportunity for a reevaluation of existing things. So even if, let's say, a company that had, you know, decided they were going to make paper in China, suddenly that whole mill has been shut down for months, and then they have the opportunity to say, wait a second, like, let's really look at the economics of this thing. Right. Are we actually paying these workers that much less than we'd be paying workers in, you know, Maine or Iowa or something like that? And I think you're going to see some of that reevaluation take place as this thing winds up.
So, but you begin your piece by talking about how companies would bring people in, fly them in, hold these meetings, and then fly them back out. The idea of what you will refer to as, or they refer to as, the agglomeration effect, that, you know, people need to sort of congregate together, learn from each other, and then they go back out. Well, now I'm operating remote. We have someone hosting this meeting in a different space remote. We have our producer remote. We have someone else remote. I'm talking to you on my computer. I don't see you. I don't touch you. Obviously, we're communicating through this virtual reality that we're in. But what does that mean going forward about a lot of other things? Are we going to see that we're not going to hold big events anymore? Are we going to now move to a more sort of solitary, you talk about the idea of, you know, we might be able to breathe better, we might have a greener environment, but we might be spending more time playing video games and sort of the sense of being alone. And I'm trying to figure out how do we not choose loneliness for a response to COVID-19? How do we still figure out what is a new way of community?
I think that's, well, I would say two things. I think humans are social animals, so I'm not worried about us evolving into a species where we actually prefer the isolation of our homes. If anything, I think this is, people are already discovering how torturous it is to spend all day alone. Those workers, at least, who are fortunate enough to be able to work from home. I myself have been working on a book for the last 6 months, so I am quite familiar with the routines of not talking to anybody all day and being alone in the house. And I'm happy to offer tips about that. But here's the
that's your next article at Slate.com.
the long-term thing, though, there's two separate things, right? One is all these digital technologies that we're using now to replace our old ways. So, for example, you guys doing this show today for the first time on Zoom, or yoga classes or gym classes or therapy all being switched online, those kinds of things might stick around, not because people are still going to be afraid of the pandemic, but just because they will have gotten used to them. They will have tried them out. They will have said, well, actually, I broke my routine and this isn't so bad. So that's part of it. And then the other thing is the social thing. Like I said, I think people will want to go outside and see people when this is over. I imagine that New York and Chicago, miss St. Patrick's Day, you know, when they usually dye the river green. It's a huge celebration. And I think when this is all over, there's going to be a party like we've never seen before. I mean, it's just going to be wild. And I'm already looking forward to that.
I was imagining you last night, Henry. You're so funny.
But the other thing is, I think at this point we have to ask if the infrastructure that we rely upon to engage in social activities is still going to be there. Are the restaurants going to be there? Are the movie theaters going to be there? Are the bars going to be there? These are places that have really low margin businesses, and they're right now facing the decision about whether to continue to pay rent, whether to continue to pay workers. And once they lose their spaces, they lose their workers. And if this goes on for, as the president said the other day, until July or August, are we going to see these places just bounce back overnight? Clearly not. So I think the other question is, what types of social infrastructure are going to be around when we come out on the other side? And that makes me a little nervous.
And also from the point of view of the workers, how are they going to get jobs if their business, if their workplaces are shut down now and they come back? Are their jobs going to still be there? What are people going to do to plug back into society?
Again, I wouldn't expect workers to wait around for restaurants to reopen. I mean, I think that's one of the other issues, is that if I had been laid off from a bakery job and told, hey, we might be able to rehire you in 2 weeks, and it might be 4 weeks, and it might be 10 weeks, I would not be sitting around waiting on that. I think we're yet to see what kind of action the government is going to take to help these people, but I would immediately be looking for someplace else to make money. And then the issue becomes, once you've decided that, you know, the restaurant job is no longer for you and you're settled in at the, you know, N95 mask factory or whatever, maybe your life has changed. And again, when these things start back up, I wouldn't expect, I don't know if the operators will be able to keep going, and I would not expect the workers to come running back either.
All right. So let me just ask another question as I'm thinking about this. So this is testing us in a lot of different ways. We're going to be isolated in a way that we haven't. We're going to learn what the new normal is. And maybe some of us are going to find out that this isolation, this new way of working works. I mean, I may never go back to my radio studio as a result of this. I mean,
no,
I like
don't
the idea.
Say that.
No. All right. Well, you know what I mean? But there is something about that human connection. I remember when I was thinking about social media and about people falling in love and having these relationships online and all this other stuff. And I remember this one radio talk show host many, many years ago, this is probably 10 years ago, was talking about this guy calls in and he said, I think I've fallen in love. I feel like I've never felt so intimate with someone. And she reminded him that, no. What you've been doing with this person is typing. Mm-hmm. You haven't been creating a relationship. You've been typing. So what I'm trying to figure out is, these people are going to find new jobs, but aren't they still going to want to congregate to eat? I can't imagine a restaurant not being revived because people are still going to want that small sense of community. And I don't want it to be McDonald's because it's big and it might offer me some stability. I'm almost wondering if maybe mid-size disappears and what you get are the sort of small niche things that survive and then the big ones. So there isn't going to be that middle-sized large restaurant that churns people out, but that we're still going to need things that reflect an intimacy of a community and not losing that. That's the part that I fear, is I think that's something that I think people need to almost hold themselves together like Velcro, Henry.
I think that's absolutely true. But then the question is, again, these communities take time to build. You know, I think we saw this after the last recession, that it takes a while for things to come back to where they were. You know, once a restaurant can close in a day, but it doesn't open in a day.
Well, and let's remember, we've lived through this. We saw Main Street disappear, and then the box stores came in. Then we saw the box stores disappear, and Amazon came in. It wasn't seamless. It didn't happen overnight. It to some extent it happened slowly, and it becomes the new normal, and people now almost expect it. So the question then will be, after COVID-19, what is this new normal, and what is it that we can cherry pick? One last thing, and then I may actually ask you to stay on the line if we don't get Rebecca Lieber. This may have to be edited out, who's supposed to come on from Mother Jones, and she has not gotten back to me about 9:30, and I may want to talk about the bailout of the airlines industry, Henry, because I think this is too important, because I think bailouts are what we're going to be hearing a lot about for the next, you know, 5 months. But I want to get back to the piece that you wrote about how we adjust, we're not going back. And that is that as you look at this going forward, what I'm trying to figure out is this more reason why We need an incredibly secure safety net. And what I mean by that is that I'm looking at the gig workers. I'm looking at the fact that I've had to be nimble for companies, but no one has been nimble for me. And what COVID-19 is showing us is that in a way, that sense of security and stability not only gets me through a COVID-19, but it will get me through trying to figure out what the new jobs are going to look like, because they're not going to open up overnight. It's going to be a rolling return to an economy with a very changing economic face. So if that's going to happen, then who's going to be nimble for me as I try to figure out what the next job looks like and where do I need to be to get it?
I think that's it's absolutely right. I think. Well, we're going to see what happens in the next few months, but I think it's going to become apparent that a lot of these situations are really precarious, and there is no aspect of sort of the American little boom that we just experienced, beginning at the end of the Great Recession, than healthcare again, and to have. Just as we were having this argument about the insufficiency of the American healthcare system, and I'm not just talking about people who are uninsured, people who are insured but can't get an elective surgery because they know it's going to set them back $8,000 because of their right. High deductible, right? Like this is there is almost something like it narratively, it's almost too cute to have this crisis come along and just say, oh, you were wondering, you thought that the healthcare system was actually like sufficient and providing for people. Yeah. So one of the issues that was raised during the Democratic debate on Sunday night was what's going to happen to undocumented immigrants? We know there's, approximately 10 million undocumented people in this country. How are we going to make sure that they can seek healthcare without fear of arrest or deportation? And if they can't, then it's not just a sort of moral issue in denying care to the people who live with us. But I think what this disaster shows is that we're only as strong as the weakest people in society. And there's a long history, I think, of pandemics and making people aware of that. You know what I mean? Like this is, we saw that, cholera was one of the impetuses for providing clean drinking water for everybody, because people start to realize that your health is only as good as the man next to you. And the influenza pandemic in Europe in 1918 and 1919 was one of the reasons that all those European countries wound up with universal healthcare systems. So on the optimistic side, I would say that, whatever the horrors that are about to unfold, and make no mistake, it is going to get worse. I hope that on the other side, it's the thing that finally makes everybody realize that it doesn't make us any stronger or any richer to deprive people of their basic livelihood when they lose their jobs. It's not just immoral. It's economically counterproductive, even for the people who have things.
So, last but not least, and then we're going to sort of button up this conversation. And that is that not only have I been talking ad nauseum about where do undocumented immigrants go for their health care, how do they get tested? Again, our biggest audience is Houston, Texas, that has 600,000 undocumented immigrants in Houston. Undocumented immigrants in Houston, that they're not going to get health care, that they're not going to be tested. You've just basically made Houston 15 times more vulnerable. I mean, more than that. I wish I knew the math on that. So you're absolutely right. This is where the idea of universal healthcare is important. You don't need to have a passport. You don't need to have an ID. You just need to walk in and say, I'm sick.
We not only make 600,000 immigrants, undocumented immigrants in Houston more vulnerable, but everybody who comes in contact with them once this crisis ends and people are free to walk around or fly in and out of Houston Airport, those 600,000 people aren't going to be sitting at home, licking their wounds of their virus.
But more important, Henry, the other thing is, this may be another opportunity for you to write at Slate.com. All of a sudden, I realize how much we need undocumented immigrants. Because when we're looking at the food supply and the food chain and the meat chain and the this chain, guess who does it? isn't as prominent in those places. So not only do you want them to be tested, you want them to be healthy, but you want them to be available because they're going to be picking the fruit, because they're going to be in the, you know, in Iowa with, at the meatpacking plants. So this is a really interesting opportunity, not only to expand the conversation on healthcare, but to have a real come to Jesus moment on how we're dealing with our immigration policy. Because all of a sudden, it's not that they're here, it's that they're needed here.
These people have always been integral to American communities in a way that I think many people don't realize. They think of people who have a more, let's say, aggressive view on immigration security, think about undocumented immigrants as people crossing the border. No, not at all. Most of them overstay their visas and arrive by plane. And most of them have been here for 10, 15, 20 years. They have U.S. citizen children in the school system here. They are not just, so like I was saying, they're in our communities, a member of American society like anybody else. And I think that I hope that there's some sort of decision that gets come to about how we're going to make sure that they feel comfortable seeking health care.
That was part of the 2020 debate between Bernie and Biden. It was a really interesting conversation about immigration and about the fact that this vulnerability and I do think that, you know, if there is going to be change in 2020, we all will have been impacted for this. Even those people who've supported Donald Trump and drunk the Kool-Aid are going to realize that, you know, that Kool-Aid killed. And if they continue to believe that, they will be the most vulnerable, and they don't want to be vulnerable. They thought that Trump would be, you know, their solution, and what they're going to find out is that he may be their poison. And in the end, you don't poison your family; you want to protect them. So I do think that the change will happen, and in a way, COVID-19 is a lot like a precursor to climate change, but it also gives us an opportunity to both face the experience, face an ending, which gives you maybe new insight on what your future wants to be. And I think that's hopeful. Henry Graeber writes for Slate.com. He is one of the most prescient writers. Every time I read you, I'm thinking, my God, how did you know? How did you know? So I do recommend that you go to Slate.com. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude. Yes, Henry.
Arnie, I want to say one more thing before you let me go. Yeah. Let's not forget that the reason that everything is shut down right now is because we never had enough tests to know who was carrying the virus and who wasn't. And that we may talk about how we have systemic flaws in the way we treat immigrants, in our healthcare system, in our gig economy and all that. But the reason we don't have enough tests is because Donald Trump for months sought to underplay what was happening and actually said, I would like the numbers to be lower. In other words, don't test people. I don't want to know what the numbers are.
Well, and not only
that's
that,
a very but the
arrogance, Henry, of saying no to the WHO when they said, here are the tests.
I know. Now every restaurant in New York is closed because we have no idea who is carrying the disease.
Henry Graeber, you are the best. Let me just tell you.
And Henry should know that I think his last comment is really a segue into Rebecca's discussion that we're going to have about ignoring science.
Yes, so thank you so much.
You gotta take facts seriously.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day workers at Wagner Electric in St. Louis ended their 12-day walkout in exchange for promised negotiations regarding union recognition, higher wages, and fewer work hours. Wagner held defense contracts to provide detonators and firing pins for munitions. With the U.S. entrance into World War I, the orders increased, as did the labor shortage. In this instance, more women entered the workforce. Wagner was no exception. During this period, nearly a quarter of the St. Louis factory workers were female. Yet, the unionized industries made no attempt to organize them. Amid a strike that rocked the city, about 1,000 men and women struck at Wagner on March 6th. They demanded the reinstatement of co-workers who had been fired for attending a machinist union meeting. A week later, close to 2,700 workers were on strike. The male workers at Wagner made less than half of their counterparts in the unionized industries, while their women co-workers made half of that. Workers contended that Wagner violated federal contracts by refusing to honor the 8-hour workday and equal pay for equal work. Historian Rosemary Furrer notes the Ordnance Department reached a tentative deal to get workers back to the job, and then spiked negotiations by smearing strikers as unpatriotic. The company refused to address long-standing grievances. According to Catherine Corbett, Wagner Electric also required workers to sign loyalty pledges to the company. Over half of the workforce would walk out the following month with the support of Mother Jones. Workers appealed to a more sympathetic War Labor Board, but found they could not get the agreements they demanded until the years of industrial organizing of the 1930s. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
This is part two of the first remote edition of The Attitude, March 18th. I can't believe it, we're doing it through Zoom to create radio for you and the Pacifica Network. So we're being joined right now by Rebecca Lieber. She is an environmental reporter at Mother Jones. And Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me. I wanted everyone to know that part of my concern about COVID-19, part of my concern about the 2020 primary is that it's been the great distraction. And that's exactly what the Trump administration loves, because as we are looking everywhere else, they continue to dismantle government. They continue to dismantle things that really are necessary for our safety and security. And you wrote a piece at Mother Jones that was entitled, "The Trump Administration is Enshrining the Anti-Science Policy in the Midst of an Epidemic." And I just thought it was absolutely frightening, your piece. And in some ways, it's also, I guess, referred to as the censored science rule. But it's interesting to me that not only did you write about this sort of rejection of science, but in a bizarre way, it also relates directly to what we are addressing right now with COVID-19. So walk us back and explain to us what the administration is doing, why we need to pay attention now, and what it means for us to create even greater sort of health and safety vulnerability. And you also threaded it to COVID-19, which I thought at first was a stretch, but makes so much sense as I look back. So welcome to the program, Rebecca. And again, remind us what has been going on. We are remembering it from months ago, but we need to pay attention because it's happening now and it's galloping into a reality.
Right. Life continues, even though things are changing so quickly with COVID-19. But last week, so just I think as the nation was really waking up to this crisis, the EPA moved forward this rule that has been nicknamed by opponents the censored science rule. And I think this is the rule, when you think about everything the EPA has done in the Trump administration, this is the rule that kind of encapsulates it all, because it is basically locking in this anti-science policy into regulatory policy that becomes a lot harder to change, even if a Democrat were to take over after this year. So this rule basically—
Let me stop you here, Rebecca. I read that in your article at Mother Jones, that they are galloping to do this, that they're going to make, they want to make it complete and they want to make it part of the regulatory pattern before 2020. And then you made that just statement that it would be hard for Democrats to undo this. Why? Why would it be hard? Because isn't sort of regulations and rulemaking based on whatever the law is? And they can't they come back and say, wait a second, the regulatory policy you've embraced undermines what the law is that we passed. You need to renegotiate those rules and regulations, because in fact, what they're doing is they're undercutting what we intended as opposed to enhancing what we intended.
Yeah, so that's where this gets complicated, because the EPA has basically, to try to simplify this, regulations are a process and they have to hit a lot of different check marks just to put one in place. So that's what the Trump administration has had to do when it's both, mostly when it's deregulated things. It has to submit a draft of the deregulation, it has to collect public comments, it has to publish that, it has to then revise and consider those comments and then move forward. So there's a lot of different steps here. It can take upwards of several years just to see a rule finalized. And that's why we're seeing in year three of the Trump administration so many rules really reaching that stage. And the same goes for a Democrat too.
Okay.
So if a Democrat comes in, it becomes a bit harder to just simply sign an executive order and roll it back day one if that rule has been finalized in the Trump administration. So here what we're seeing with the science rule.
Hold on, let me stop you here. So we had a conversation the other day, and the conversation was, and it's a great quote from Elizabeth Warren. And Elizabeth Warren says that personnel is policy. And the idea is who I pick is really sort of defines a little bit about how policy is gonna be followed. So I understand that, for example, you know, from my old law school days, the idea of prosecutorial discretion, the idea of enforcement. As we look at perhaps a changing administration, and I know what the administration, the Trump administration wants to do, which is to censor science. If you have a new EPA, you bring in people within the bureaucracy that believe in science, even though you may not be able to, quote unquote, change the rule and the regulation that easily, what you can do because of new voices, new administration, new leadership, you can at least blunt the effect of what Trump is trying to do by the end of his, I'm hoping, his administration in 2020. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's completely true that personnel matters, that who is in charge, it certainly matters. I think though, looking at it this way, at this race to the finish that the Trump administration is trying to do, it makes a lot of these things fit into place that, because you might be wondering, why would the EPA move forward with this rule even when the Trump administration has a lot bigger of a crisis on its hands? And you could interpret it as this is pretty nefarious where they're trying to sneak this through, but they also have a hard deadline to finish these rules if they want to crystallize this policy. So that deadline is actually May, surprisingly enough, because of it makes it a lot harder for the next Congress to overturn if they are wrapped up by May. So that's why we're seeing the EPA now rush forward with this rule that has hit a few delays along the way that would drastically change how the EPA considers science in all of its policymaking.
All right, so tell me, what does that mean? What do you mean by not considering science? Is it that they don't look at the sort of Encyclopedia Britannica of all the different studies that have been done? Are they hiding part of the studies? Are they not explaining what the underlying study is? What does this censor of science mean? And what are they excluding that has not been excluded before?
Yeah, this started as a pet project actually of a few climate deniers in Congress. So that gives you the origins of where this idea comes from. Lamar Smith in the House, who was a noted climate denier, who's now retired. But the EPA is borrowing this policy that says they can't consider any studies that don't publish all their raw data. Now, when you think about that, it might make sense. Why not have more transparency? So that's what Republicans have argued, that this is right, a rule for transparency in science. The problem with that is when you're talking especially about medical data, this is data that's private by law that actually researchers can't possibly publish because of medical privacy laws. So what it does in effect is it removes a huge swath of research from what the EPA can consider going forward. So it just basically cuts it all out and says, you can only look at the literature that meets these very strict requirements, which basically removes some very seminal work that includes the Harvard Six Cities study that it forms basically the basis of all of our ozone pollution laws that shows the effect pollution has on public health. It removes those studies from consideration. So effectively you're weakening the EPA's position to base any policy on science. It applies a lot more broadly than just the air pollution rules. It applies to water regulation, it applies to climate regulation. And as you mentioned in my piece, I talked to some sources about how if there is a possible coronavirus tie-in, and indeed there's effects that beyond what we can probably imagine at this time of how this would affect the EPA's work.
So make the connection to COVID-19, because you did actually do that. Because again, if we're going to create greater potential for pollution, greater potential for poor quality water. What we know is the people that live in those areas where there is greater pollution tend to be the most vulnerable, tend to be people of color, tend to be, I mean, people who live outside of certain places of Houston, people who live in certain places in New Orleans. I mean, where are they living? They're living in toxic dumps. And now what we're doing is we're making it even more toxic because we're not going to allow these studies to show that they're toxic. And therefore, they're the most susceptible to COVID-19 and they're the most susceptible to die. And since we don't have the respirators, we don't have the hospital beds, basically what we're doing is we're saying you're expendable.
Right. I'll say that this is definitely a hypothetical right now because things obviously are so early in stages on COVID-19. But right. One of the hypotheticals of something that the EPA might consider doing down the road is looking at the relationship between exposure to pollution and vulnerability to respiratory the respiratory disease. And of course, we actually see this link on other diseases that pollution does make you more vulnerable. So it's possible this exists. It has not been established in the research yet for COVID-19. But the EPA would basically really struggle to even study that link because it wouldn't be allowed to consider any of the research. Including the research requiring scientists to look at the hospital data to get data blocked out of patient privacy, such as like their names and specific addresses. The EPA would not be able to move forward on that.
All right, so we're talking with Rebecca Lieber. She's the environmental reporter at Mother Jones. Her title of the piece was "The Trump Administration is enshrining its anti-science policy in the midst of an epidemic." Is this a slam dunk, Rebecca? Is there any way to stop this? You tell me that, you know, they've been doing this for a couple of years. It takes a couple of years. They've got until May to do this. Obviously, no one's going to be talking about this except for maybe me and you on the radio or on MSNBC or on CNN, God help us, because we're so obsessed about this and we're counting deaths and beds and temporary hospitals and respirators and face masks. And yet, I feel like as I'm talking to you, I feel like there's no way to stop this. Like, they have been doing this for so long. The Trump administration sees the great distraction. You know, he may be frightened by it, but the people that are now in control of the EPA see this as a great opportunity. And because you said that there has to be this level of transparency, what that basically says is anything that relates to health, a study can never really be used. Because if health is related to people and people are protected because you know, their privacy is protected by the different rules that relate to these kinds of studies, then what they've basically done is said, the health of Americans is the easiest and the most expendable when it comes to EPA as they move forward and set their rulemaking.
There are a few things that can be done here. And one is the courts, and that has been a strategy of environmentalists throughout the Trump administration. It's been a fairly successful strategy, at least in the lower courts, if not the Supreme Court, where courts have sided along with critics of the Trump administration because it has not followed all the rules in rolling back regulations or it's found to violate the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. So this will certainly be challenged once it's finalized. That is one path that critics have to...
Yeah, but remember, let's remind everyone about the Trump administration packing the courts with corporatists and, you know, young people that will live till like they're 202 and well, because they're being appointed practically in utero.
It's definitely not a sure thing, but the environmentalists have had a pretty successful track record so far. Okay. It was well over 90% in challenging the Trump administration on rules.
And can I just add, Rebecca, that in addition to challenging it because the agencies did not follow the Administrative Procedure Act or did not properly promulgate the rules, environmental groups also can and have challenged the Trump regs and other regs on the basis of the fact that the regs exceed the authority, go outside the statute. So the Environmental Protection Act, Clean Water Act, all those things that were passed by Congress, if an agency tries to promulgate rules that differ from that congressional intent, those rules can be challenged in court and struck down. And that's been very successful for environmental organizations, I don't know, for 50 years now.
Yeah, that's a great point. That argument might appeal more to the conservative justices as well. And it also They have a good argument that the EPA's mandate by Congress is based in science, and if you are eliminating the science, that violates it. So they do have a few things on their side, and maybe that's one way to hold out hope.
Well, but my other concern is that obviously because we're in this new world from COVID-19, we're going to see some significant delays now in what's going to happen with courts. So because this is a significant delay in whether courts can actually convene, and now you've got this deadline of May, you know, which rises to the higher level, meeting the deadline or going to court? So, you know, we really are in such an incredible new world. So Rebecca, I'm glad we're talking about this. I need to pay attention to it. You have to keep writing about it, but you also have to tell us a little bit about your second piece, which I just went berserk about. And that is that as we're thinking, aren't we excited about getting off the oil and gas teat? We're moving to sustainable energy. You know, I've got 18 solar panels on my roof, Rebecca. You should love me, you know. I wish I lived in a place where I could have geothermal in my backyard, but you know, and I'm conservation. Now I read your other piece and I just want everyone to wake up because this was incredible. And that is that the oil and gas industry is looking at, well, we're not going out of business. We're just going to morph into something else. And you wrote, your plastic addiction is bankrolling big oil. Oh, my freaking you know what. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, I know that plastic, I keep thinking about some of those old movies when it was the new concept, but what are oil and gas doing? And talk to me a little bit about this sort of plastics thing, which we know about and we're concerned about and we're trying to sort of maybe decouple from plastics, but as we're trying to change our plastic behavior, we're being gonna see a significant pushback from oil and gas.
Yeah, I think, so in writing this, I wanted to look at a side of the plastics problem that I don't think talk about very much. We talk a lot about recycling and consumption, how that needs to be improved, and we need to cut back on how much plastic we use. But there's the other end of it that I'm not sure everyone understands fully, and that's the production side. Who is actually responsible for as much plastic as we have? And that's where oil and gas comes in. So plastic is a fossil fuel. It starts as a fossil fuel. And the one reason we have seen such a big boom in plastics production, especially in the US, is we've had a major gas boom that's been driven by fracking. And that has made plastics a extremely profitable operation because gas inputs have been so cheap that it makes plastic production a lot cheaper. And you see now oil and gas companies increasingly become petrochemical companies where they're plastics companies. They are actually building facilities that are rival the biggest in the world to produce more plastics. And these aren't plastics that are necessarily consumed in America. They would be exported for consumption and production around the world, but this is happening along the Gulf Coast, especially in Western Pennsylvania, places where we've seen big fracking booms.
So tell me about fracking and plastic. What's the story there? It never occurred to me that there would be a connection. I mean, I've always known about petrol products and I always know about, you know, plastic, but I have this sort of like fuzzy connection about plastics and oil and gas, but fracking. I don't quite comprehend. What's the connection between fracking and plastics?
So fracking is, of course, a process used to extract gas. And it has, it's actually a very profitable process, a pretty relatively cheap for oil companies as opposed to drilling offshore, which is a very expensive enterprise. So fracking has boomed, and what the product of that, one byproduct of fracking is ethane, which is a type of greenhouse gas, and that is then used to turn into plastics products at ethane crackers. Now, these are plants that process the gas at extremely high heat and use a lot of power driven by oil and gas in the first place just to get to those high temperatures. And that transforms the inputs into what we would recognize more as plastics, or at least the pellets and resins that turn into the products we can recognize.
Oh, Sorry, everyone. So as we're looking at this, what I'm trying to figure out, is there any way to address the plastics issue? I mean, we're so worried about it, what's happening in the ocean. We know we can't recycle it because China has said no to recycling. So we're going to see this sort of over and over consumption. We know we can't put it in our landfills because they stay forever. We know we don't want to burn it because it pollutes. So how are they going to be successful in selling this?
Well, in terms of what can be done, I think a lot of it comes down to production, and that's why I wanted to look at that in for this story rather than talking about just demand. I think some of the policies have to focus on fracking production and on gas production, that you, if you start to look at these processes, try to make them at least adhere to more environmental regulation, then you might start to address the flood on the market. There's, of course, a lot of other things we can do, but the solution isn't in recycling necessarily. It's looking at the production side as well. And it isn't just about cleaning up the oceans, which is important as well. So for petrochemicals, I think right now we're of course in a really chaotic period because of course,
because of what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Russia and everything else that's going on.
Yeah, the prices have been crashing. That does introduce a lot of questions around what is happening with oil. But right now, the Trump administration is talking about a big bailout for the industry. So this could go in a few different directions. We could actually take this opportunity to think harder about how much oil and gas should be part of our economy when we're in this crisis, right. But of course Trump, that's not the way they would like to operate. Go right. And I think right now we're really at this this fork in the road where we can actually change this path that has felt inevitable, that we have just endless oil production, endless petrochemical production, and we can think more critically about that.
Well, and as you point out, through the entire process of creating these plastics, you're creating more and more pollution. You're contributing more that the plastics process could replace all the coal that we've been shutting down because of what it would do to the environment. So the consequences are even greater to some extent. We think we're cleaning up the environment by going to gas, and what we're finding out is that we're turning the gas into plastics. Then what we're doing is we're recreating a coal plant. So in a lot of ways, we haven't improved anything. We've just reinvented the problem. We haven't changed the problem.
Yeah, and I think we think about plastic pollution as just what ends up in our oceans and wildlife right. and waterways, and that of course is a huge part of the problem, but on the production side alone, you are venting really toxic fumes into communities of color, into the same communities that have suffered from coal plants like you've mentioned and other chemical plants. And so there is a huge environmental justice story here as well. And I think it's a piece of the plastics issue that we don't normally focus on because we it is easier to grasp on to the images of birds who are filled with plastic bottle caps. And right. those are the images we're most familiar with in the plastics problem, but there's this more invisible side of it too.
Well, and it's the invisible side that just seems to be incredibly toxic. So the last thing I'm thinking about is that what we know about right fracking is that because of what's happening with Russia and Saudi Arabia, that it's the fracking industry that I think is the most vulnerable. It's highly leveraged. It was able to sort of look cheaper because of what was happening, but now the Saudis and the Russians are changing that. And what you're mentioning now about fracking and pollution and fracking and a lot of communities around the country don't want fracking. What is it? Isn't it in Oklahoma where they're having all these earthquakes, you know, as a result of this? So I think it's a really interesting opportunity as we're addressing COVID-19 and the huge amount of money that we're asking the government to make an investment in. This is the one thing that, you know, the last thing I want to see be given a dime is that we don't give a dime to maintain fracking, because on so many levels, it's wrong, 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 wrong. But it also means that's another couple of billion or trillion that aren't going into providing people's ability to respond to COVID-19. So it's going to be very interesting to see how Congress defends fracking as people are saying, how do I eat?
Yeah, it does have, we've seen that in polls. There's been a lot of talk about this in Pennsylvania, of whether this is the issue that the election turns on, the fracking bans. The thing is, even in Pennsylvania, there is quite a big split in polling showing that communities near fracking aren't necessarily in favor of it, while there are of course towns in Pennsylvania that are hugely reliant for their economy that are more in favor. It is definitely a polarized issue. It is also the most vulnerable of operations in what's happening to the oil markets right now, because fracking can be taken offline and online. These operations and rigs, they can be shut down at an environmental cost, but and then reopened once it becomes profitable again. So right now, if the oil industry is saying they're in a crisis mode, thinking longer term, which they certainly are, they are hoping that these operations come right back.
Well, I think someone needs to buy a billboard, and they need to include in the billboard that bit of nugget from your piece where you talk about what fracking and making plastics would mean, and that it's basically for every coal plant you're shutting down, you're actually almost recreating another coal plant by the fracking and then the development of the plastics, that this really is adding to our environmental degradation as well as our air degradation that's causing climate change. I didn't know that at all, Rebecca, until I read your piece. That, I'm thinking, I'm feeling happy about the fact that we're closing all these power plants. And you wrote, if plastics production continues apace, the sector is on track to reach the equivalent annual pollution of 295 large coal plants in the next 10 years and double that by 2050. We don't like coal. We hate this. So thank you,
Rebecca,
so much for writing.
Can I just say before we close this conversation, Rebecca, would it be fair to expand your point? I think you're talking about how we can rethink how we've been looking at plastics, but in fact, with this coronavirus crisis, it gives us the opportunity and almost requires us to rethink almost everything, like we were talking about with our previous guest, rethinking the economy, what jobs we're going to convert to, rethinking the environment, and how much.
We're losing you, Ken. You're going in and out.
An opportunity. So it's a bigger opportunity to rethink than just the plastics issue, don't you think?
Well, I think, Rebecca, you will agree with that. The problem is Donald Trump administration has one agenda, and then maybe a next administration would have another agenda. Rethinking is really about the new leadership.
Yes, absolutely.
It's kind of a crisis is a time to also, things move very quickly, but it's also a time to think seriously about the choices we're making. And we're seeing a little bit, I'm not exactly hopeful about the Trump administration, but we're seeing some chances for Democrats and Republicans to now talk about paid leave. That didn't seem possible a very short time ago, just weeks
exactly.
ago. So
yeah.
I'm not going to say it's impossible that we actually have this conversation. I think we should be talking more about this. I hope that we do think more seriously about both our production and also on we're rethinking, I think, globalization in a way, just because we are realizing how interconnected the world is
Rebecca, I need to let you go, but you're ending on exactly how Henry Graeber began our conversation.
Which was what I was interjecting. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're really coming full circle. I'm so glad that while we touched on COVID-19, it didn't dominate this conversation. The idea of sort of doing everything remote and alone didn't become part of this conversation. We talked about the real issues that we need to face. Science needs to be addressed. We need to understand what the Trump administration is. We're looking to the right, they're looking to the left. And also it gives us more food for thought as we look at the 2020 election and as to why we may want to have new leadership and new direction. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for writing for Mother Jones, and I'm glad you do the environmental beat. You're a great talker and a great writer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the first edition of The Remote Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Talk to you tomorrow.